It is Saturday, November 7th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is independent public radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxel, and with me in the studio is Bonnie Jean Primsch, mediator, art dabbler, and broadcaster. Hey, Bonnie.
Howdy.
Brian Young, a CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinkerer.
Hey, Lyle.
And Ben Jaffe, a teacher, traveler, and music geek.
Hi. The best thing that happened to me this week happened to me this week.
Oh, congratulations.
That's a tautology. Star Trek, there's a new series coming in 2017.
A series?
How does that relate to the tautology?
Yes, a series. Oh, I just said that the best thing that happened to me this week happened to me this week.
Isn't that redundant?
It's just a tautology.
What happened to me happened to me. Yeah.
So why did you start with that?
Just because I thought it was funny.
Oh, okay. So tell us about the Star Trek episodes.
Okay, I can't give any details because the articles that are talking about this are very light on the details. This happened literally today, the day that we recorded this episode, and someone told me about this in the break room at lunch.
Did you get all giddy?
I thought they were messing with me. I'm like, don't do that. Don't get my hopes up like that, because it's been many, many years since we've had a non-movie.
Do we know the time frame? Do we know any of the actors?
We don't know the timeline. We don't know how it fits into the overall story.
We don't know if it's old Trek or a new Trek. We don't know if it's in the future or in the past. We don't know anything.
But it will be on broadcast television? CBS?
It'll be on CBS, and it will be released through one of their whiz-bang new subscription service models, something.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
But don't tell them that. I probably shouldn't say this on radio, but I will pay any amount of money to watch these these episodes.
Well, I imagine that's why this deal is less for CBS about the fact that it's Star Trek and more about the fact that they are going to hook so many people into their new subscription service with this thing.
There are many people as crazy about Star Trek as I am.
There is no one as crazy about Star Trek as you are.
There are a few, a select few.
That's true.
If they're going to reboot the series, they should do it from the point of view of an alien race that meets a ship from the Federation.
You're hired.
Yeah. So, okay, has anyone else seen the Star Wars trailer and got giddy? Because I got giddy in that.
Star Wars, whatever.
I will remove your mic from ability of recording.
I am interested in that too. Just okay. It does more excited
good.
About the Star
it looks
Trek.
Good.
Is it possible not to see it until you actually go see the movie?
The trailer?
Yeah.
Did you not see the trailer?
I have not seen it yet.
Maybe you can show the trailer right before the movie, Brian. I'm sure that'll work.
if you have the ability to wait it out, sure, why not wait it out?
I'm going
to
try.
I was excited. I was going to see it anyway, but...
We won't foist it on
Who
you,
got
Brian.
Tickets already?
Not me.
Oh, I did. Okay, so who's the Star Wars nerd in the house?
Not me.
Go. Hey, Bonnie, tell us why we should go to geekspeak.org.
Oh, hey, guys, there's going to be a thing there. It's from this guy, Richard Balzer, who has been diligently digitizing old-timey animations. These are physical objects that you'd hold in your hand or interact with, like a zoetrope where you'd look through a little slit and something would spin and you'd see an animation go by.
A disc with a whole bunch of pictures on the inside and slices in between them. And then as you look through the slices and it spins, you see an animated circle.
Mm-hmm. These are the things that you see at the Exploratorium.
Yeah.
Or another one is magic lanterns. And I saw an example of one of these in a TV show, weirdly. Where you spin the strings and the disc in the middle spins around, and if you spin it fast enough, then on one side you see an empty cage, and on the other side you see a bird, and when you spin it, it looks like the bird's in the cage.
So this person's filming these things and then making...
and turning them into GIFs. They were essentially the world's original GIFs. And he is turning them into modern day GIFs.
And he's got a whole collection of them at dickblazer.tumblr.com, or you can get to it from
Balzer. It's Balzer,
BALZER.tumblr.com. Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Another thing they have there are phoenakistoscopes.
What is a phoenakistoscope?
I've never heard that word before.
That's a new one.
It's like a zoetrope, but different in some way.
And we're not going to get into that. You figured out.
Yeah.
Let us know what you think. You can email us
at
geekspeak.org. Yeah. Hey, Ben, it's time to talk about the internets of things. First off, I don't like the idea of the internet of things.
Why?
But it just seems a little ridiculous.
Well, we already have an internet made of things.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, things is not a very good descriptive word.
Right, right. So it's not a very great
it's
name.
More fun than tubes.
Yeah, it's not a technically accurate name, but what it's trying to get at is it's the same internet, right? But now that now there are much smaller things, like my wristwatch.
And it's the explosion of the internet being on many of these things. That's right. Why it's the description.
And it's not a separate thing that's come out, a separate internet of separate things, but it's more referring, I guess, to the phenomenon, I can never pluralize that right, of small things going on the internet, like toaster. Or whatever.
Light bulbs, door locks, watches,
refrigerators,
robotics that fly in the world. Anything that could potentially have a computer and be connected to the internet is happening.
Right.
And that's the Bollywood.
Now, this seems like a really great, cool idea. And of course, the one thing that people have not been thinking about, many people, I should say, or focusing on, is, of course, security. The thing that nobody focuses on until they've been compromised. And then they focus on it and think, gosh, if only I had thought about this before. So
they lament at that point, actually.
They lament.
Then comes the lamenting.
It's similar to backups, incidentally. If you haven't backed up, I recommend you back up before your hard drive fails.
What do you use as backup, Ben?
I use Time Machine for my boot drive, and I use an application called Super Duper.
Yeah.
There's another one called Carbon Copy Cloner, which I also love, but I don't really have a need to use two different pieces
of. Do you run them automatically? I mean, Time Machine, you run automatically, but the other ones you don't?
Yeah, so Time Machine runs automatically whenever I plug in my big external disk. The other one I trigger manually every couple weeks or so.
All right,
but the stuff on my external drive doesn't change very much.
So people don't think about backups, which you should because you need to, and they don't think about security.
Right.
And that's happening in this new world of Internet of Things.
Especially in this new world of Internet of Things, there are all these different things that are now going onto the Internet, and they're little like one use things, two use things, five use things, you know, like, so here's a couple examples of some vulnerabilities that we've already seen in the Internet of Things. There were some critical vulnerabilities in a range of Internet of Things baby monitors. These are just basically baby monitors that connect up to the internet so you can, you know, monitor your child while you're further away or whatever. The problem is that there were a bunch of vulnerabilities that people were able to leverage to monitor the feeds or change the camera settings or authorize other people to view and control the monitor.
Which is a little disturbing because, of course, these are cameras and audio recording devices in your
home. In your house, yeah. It's not just about like, okay, they can watch your baby. They can also figure out, are these people home or not?
It's interesting because baby monitors have been around a long time and they used to work with AM transmission. And you could actually pick them up with other devices and look in on the signal.
Yeah, but now they have video.
And that was also only a block away, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't like a long distance thing.
Right.
And now it's an internet thing.
Right, so there's that. There's internet-connected cars, which I'll be talking about a little bit more in a minute or so. We've got smartwatches. We've got medical devices. So what could go wrong, right? So let's just go through these one by one. Smartwatches, actually, I'll start with medical devices. Medical devices, obviously, medical information can be very sensitive. You don't want your medical information just getting out there or being accessible to anyone easily. But also, something that a lot of people don't think about is medical devices actually sometimes do things. Like maybe they inject a certain amount of something-something into your bodies to regulate something-something. I'm not a doctor, clearly.
I could see.
but the idea that somebody could compromise these and then be able to change what's happening with your body, that's a lot scarier, right? Smartwatches. This is an interesting one I didn't know.
Can we back up on medical for just
sure.
a second?
Yeah.
I don't understand how you could potentially build something that deals with medical and not have security in mind.
Well, might have basic security in mind, but maybe...
Not your primary focus.
Right. I mean, like, okay. So these devices... Even just in making a device that can connect to the internet, there's a lot of code there.
Yeah.
There's a ton of code there.
And you normally use a library from somebody else.
Right, yeah. But also those libraries might have exploits and things like that. So it's just a matter of time before exploits are discovered, and it's not something you can 100% prevent against. It's something that you can invest in trying to, harden your systems.
Wait, when you say library, is that like how modular programming is now, where you take,
right.
Like, oh, someone figured out how to make this whole applet thing happen, so I'm just going to plug it in.
Exactly.
Without necessarily examining the code in there.
Yeah, just think of all the software you use. It's all built on pieces and parts that people have been working on for decades.
And what's that called, that modular form of programming?
Well, it's enabled by open source. And the modular form of programming, you package functionality up into libraries or so.
I think you're probably thinking of object-oriented programming, which codifies that.
What's the word?
Object-oriented programming.
Yes, that.
Yeah, it's not exactly the same, but but there is this idea of concept. You know, it's a very strong pattern in software development to conceptualize, different subsets into their own structures, right? Mm-hmm. So,
but I want to back up and go back to the Internet of Things, smartwatches. This is kind of a cool thing. Like, so there are obviously things that you can imagine people could do with your smartwatch. They could change your time. Oh God, it's awful.
Make it beep.
I mean, daylight savings time is bad enough. It could make a beep. You could maybe track the user's location. You might be able to use the accelerometer for things. Turns out there's actually proof of concepts, not in the wild, that you can actually steal information about what the person is typing based on the accelerometer. So
that makes sense.
That means passwords, right? So if you compromise a smartwatch, you might be able to use that as a an escalation of privileges attack to figure out people's passwords,
or
to figure out
their password,
get into their other accounts, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that idea of an escalation of privileges attack is, I almost imagine, like, so a gremlin climbs in your bathroom window, and now he has access to your bathroom, right? But if the bathroom door isn't locked, then he can open that, and he has access to the hallway, and keeps going and going and going.
Pretty soon he's flying the plane.
Eventually he's got root access, and he can lock you out of your own house. Anyway, here's another example with internet-connected cars. There have been a number of proof of concepts. Most recently, there was one about, I think, the Jeep Wrangler, was it? The Jeep Cherokee, I'm sorry. And what happened there was some researchers were able to wirelessly hack into a Jeep Cherokee, take control of the entertainment system, and then through a escalation of privileges attack, take over the windshield wipers, and then disable the accelerator. And then disable the brakes. So, like, really big stuff. Not just, like, blast the person with loud music, but actually take control of their car and make it stop functioning. So, a couple questions, I suppose. One question which I'd like to get to is, what can consumers do about this?
Not buy these devices?
Not buy a car. I mean, so...
Yeah, that's true.
So, yeah, it's a little tricky because... on the one hand, whenever you're at the, whenever you're in the front of a wave of new technology, right, you're probably going to get bit. All the people who upgraded to OS 10, the newest version of OS 10, or the newest version of Windows, or the newest version of whatever, and they get bit with some bugs, and then they wait for a patch. You know,
normally the early adopters are the ones that do that, and sometimes they're more technical and can maybe handle it.
Right.
But your question is how. What do people do? What does the consumer do to deal with the insecurity in their pacemaker or in their watch?
Right.
I don't know if there's a lot an individual consumer can do.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of the, I guess, the worrying part about it. At the same time, I imagine that as things like this happen, I mean, like the Jeep Wrangler and a couple other things happened, and the car industry, the auto industry, has really been trying to step up their game because they're seeing now. They're not just, it's not a theory, you know, like this could happen, cars could be compromised. No, this is actually happening. So we need to make our cars better, right? So I don't know. It's kind of interesting. A couple takeaways from this particular article that I was looking over.
You have some good things to do potentially for a consumer?
Not exactly for a consumer, but more for the industry.
Oh, good. I'm glad you do. Let's talk about that in just a minute. You're listening to GeekSpeak here on KOSP. We'll be right back. You're listening to GeekSpeak on independent public radio, KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the air room is Brian Young, Bonnie Jean Primsch, and Ben, you were just talking, Ben Jaffe, you were just talking about the Internet of Things, and maybe it's a little difficult for the individual user that's consuming stuff to deal with it, but developers might have a possibility of improving security in some way.
Right, right. So a lot of everything I was talking about, part one sounds really bleak, right?
It did, yes.
It's horrible. But things are going to get better. Now that they've gotten worse. So I'm just going to read a couple of the points from this article because I think they're really on point. One is connectivity has outpaced security. So the idea is the more connections you have, the more pathways and back doors that there are. And the more pathways and back doors for a hacker to potentially get in, the more likely they're going to be able to, right? So that's
and
that's
I
one.
Don't think that's new with the Internet of Things. I think that's always the
deal. It's always been the case, yeah.
The new steps are not as secure.
It's true, regardless of what your pathways to connection are, that's a truism.
Yeah. Right, absolutely. And a lot of this is new, you know? Like, who's had to secure a toaster before? So, like, the people that they're hiring to write the software and secure the toaster probably, maybe they don't have as much experience working on hardening security systems,
sure.
In which case they should probably hire some people who do. The second is distributed systems raise new and novel cybersecurity challenges. So the idea behind that is the paradigm that we've had over the years has been, we've got this castle. This is our computer. This is our phone, right? And we have to protect this castle. So we'll put high walls around it. We'll put a moat around it. We can't really do that anymore because we've got all of these things that are connected to each other. And in more novel and unusual interconnected ways.
Yeah, a connected light bulb with a moat doesn't work as well.
Right.
It's got to be kind of lightweight in it by its nature.
Yeah, it's distributed systems. That's exactly the problem there. I've got two more for you. The next is unintended linkages are the rule, not the exception. And I'm just going to read a little paragraph because it sums up a lot. It says the Jeep Cherokee hack reportedly used the entertainment system as a way to access control over the brakes, transmission, and other driving critical functions. The hackers who accessed credit card information from millions of target shoppers in late 2013 reportedly got in using network credentials taken from a heating, ventilation, and air conditioning company contracted to do work for Target. So, those
super
are not
sideways.
Intended linkages, right? Those are unintended linkages, and this is saying they're the rule, not the exception. So we need to change our thinking about it to understand that, yeah. And to kind of, you know, figure that part out. And then the last one I want to read here is, we need a multi-layered approach to cybersecurity and not one that just focuses on the low-hanging fruit. And that's a little bit hard to understand at first, but basically, in order to do the wireless takeover of the Jeep Cherokee, Fiat Chrysler Automotives wrote, it, quote, required unique and extensive technical knowledge, prolonged physical access to a subject vehicle, and extended periods of time to write code. So
that's not a barrier.
That's not a barrier.
I don't feel.
No, but it's I guess the low-hanging fruit would be like, there, I put security tape on this thing. Now is it secure? And hackers are willing to spend some time and some involvement.
That's exactly what it is.
And some social engineering into getting at stuff.
That's exactly what it is. So there is the low-hanging fruit mentality, which actually is useful when you're talking about, say, your own passwords, right? You don't want to be the lowest hanging fruit because the easiest people to target are going to be the ones who are targeted. But when it comes to issues like this, when it comes to exploits, that's not necessarily always the case. And we need to prioritize not just the low-hanging fruit, but as much of the fruit as possible. One more last thing to say. There is also now an Internet of Things Security Foundation, which is a nonprofit body that just got started recently. And the idea there is it's going to be responsible for vetting some of the internet-connected devices for security vulnerabilities and flaws, and also will be available for security assistance to different people who are and companies who are not as ready to take on those challenges. They'll kind of pull together that information so that way it's a little bit more easy to get started securing your devices, the Internet of Things devices you're creating, cool. And thinking about it from a secure first perspective,
yeah,
rather than
sense.
Security as an afterthought.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ben.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick question. Does that article go into any systems that it thinks are doing a good job right now?
Not exactly. That's the hard thing about security is you don't know how secure you are until you've been around for a while, you know? So,
well, I wonder if that newly formed nonprofit is reachable for further conversation.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah, so just because the Jeeps were I guess taken advantage of, that doesn't mean that they were less secure than the other cars. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ben. Hi, Bonnie.
Hey. How's it going?
I'm good. Good. How you doing?
Yeah, pretty good. I've been catching up on my New Yorkers lately.
Yeah.
Which is always a trial. It's hard to do. They keep making them.
Yeah, and they keep
and
on being good.
And everyone is so rich and thick and just creamy and delicious.
Is this an ad for a New Yorker?
No, it is not. however, there is something related to rich, creamy, thick, and delicious that was in the New Yorker in the November 2nd issue that I was reading. It was a profile, basically, of this guy named Charles Spence, who is an experimental psychologist at Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And he runs an outfit called Crossmodal Labs. And he does scads and scads of research on how do other senses have an effect on an experience you're having, like with a product.
Example.
Well, about a dozen years ago, he was trying to figure out, you know, how to approach this question of, is there some way to enhance a consumer experience so they're more likely to want to interact with the product? And he was looking at Pringles.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all very uniform. So he went, oh, this is going to be a good test subject. And what he was trying to do is figure out how the quality of the sound of the chip affected the eating experience.
Okay, how do you do that?
Well, he would put headphones on the test subjects, and the sound of them biting into the chip would get fed back through the headphones, but they could process the sound.
Yeah, so they can make it quieter or louder.
Wow.
Right, quieter, louder, higher pitched, lower pitched, more intense.
Okay.
You know, sort of like more extremes, more in the middle.
So he had a ton of people come through.
How about this chip? How does this chip taste? How about this chip, right? Of course, they were all the same chip.
Right. But different people, lots
different
of test
subjects.
But different
people, lots of test subjects. And so he was able to see, like, oh, that's interesting. If it's a higher pitched sound, people have a generally fonder feeling about the chip.
Really? That was a conclusion?
Cool.
That was a conclusion that came out of that.
Oh.
So since then, he's just done a million bajillion. I think he produces like 50 to 100 different papers a year on little correlative studies like that.
Are they always about sound and taste?
No, they're also about smell.
Uh-huh.
Although he's focused quite a bit on sound, he's done some things in the non-food realm, for instance, with cars. He helped a car company develop, and it's just coming out, I think, in this year's model of something. It's in the article that will be linked
sure.
at geekspeak.org, that if you're trying to get people to pay attention fast
mm-hmm.
to warning sounds, it turns out people are more responsive to looking in front of them if they hear something coming from behind their head than if it's coming from the side.
So like if the car makes an alert sound, it's better for that to come from the back of the car
as
to get the driver to look forward?
As opposed to the side of the car, yeah.
That's really interesting.
Isn't it? So they're now developing speakers inside the headrests
mm-hmm.
That will...
I can imagine it being bad for the side because their first reaction would be look at the sound.
Right.
So from right behind them, that's equivalent to directly in front of them, except for phase mode. I mean, think that directly in front of them would be the place to put it. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay.
So when our self-driving cars need to warn us that they can't figure out what to do, we're going to hear the sound right out of our headrest, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which we'll pleasantly ignore because we'll be watching a show.
And what's interesting is there's been an uptick in this kind of research generally, and perhaps because it's lucrative. This guy is 75% funded by industry.
Ah, that want to market to people.
Yes,
sure.
That want to find out that information so they can apply it to their products.
I love the idea mm-hmm. of the Pringles meeting, and they're like, okay, this chip is great, tastes good, everything's fine. I mean, it tastes good, tastes like a Pringle.
Yeah.
But we need it to be higher pitch. Like,
yeah.
What do you do? I guess you make it thinner and
right.
more brittle. And...
But in general, it means that, you know, people are starting to pay attention to the entire experience
sure.
of a product.
Mm.
Like unboxing, for instance. The sensual experience of taking your thing out of the package. Like there's all those unboxing videos
oh,
on YouTube.
Oh, yeah. And those Bristol packages that are just so frustrating. By the time you get it open, your hand is cut, and then you have your object.
Yeah.
Versus somebody like Apple, who you know has this beautiful box and presentation.
Hershey's yeah. has known that for a long time. Says this article, like you
as in the
you,
kiss.
Yes, you unwrap the foil from the kiss, and it's like a little present. You know.
Oh.
So people are applying this more and more, and it's become a trend in neuroscience, perhaps because it pays, and perhaps also because we've gotten wise, right? We've long since figured out to
you
mute
mean us
the
consumers?
Television. The consumers
yeah.
have gotten wise.
Mm.
We know to mute the TV ads, or we fast forward them,
mm-hmm.
or we just don't click on the Google ads.
Mm-hmm.
So and you know now we're wise to product placement within content.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. advertisers have to figure out some way to get us before we can think to have a positive association with their product.
It seems that that's always been the goal, though. Like rather than strawberries at the stand in 1 mile, it's delicious strawberries at the stand in 1 mile. And
mm-hmm.
then it's delicious strawberries with a beautiful picture of a strawberry. And like all of that is kind of trying to get us earlier. I wonder how much of it is novelty too.
Well, that's a good point. There was a study in South Korea where they had some Dunkin' Donuts ads
mm-hmm.
That would air in a bus. to be like a, I don't know, like a sound file okay. or something. And with it would be a little little spritz of coffee smell.
In the bus.
Yeah, in the bus. And in the buses where the coffee smell was spritzed, there was a 19% uptick in attendance to nearby Dunkin' Donuts locations.
Oh, cool.
And there was a 20, I think I've got my numbers right, a 26% increase in people actually purchasing something once they'd gotten in there.
Okay, that's just not fair.
It's not fair, right?
How can you say no to coffee smell?
And that's, I mean, that's sort of my question, is when it's hard at the consumer level to be wise to the security of the Internet of Things, how are we in this cat and mouse game between consumers and advertisers going to get wise to the sensory input that we're getting?
Well, first off, the ads that are baked into content now are so prevalent. I agree that people pay attention to it. Is it a negative drawback when you notice it? I was watching the movie Goosebumps with the kids we just went to, and the opening sequence is the mom and son moving to town, and they're in a station wagon, don't know what they make of the car, with a old beat-up U-Haul trailer. Which is not big enough for furniture, by the way. I could tell right away that that's not really how you move across country.
Yeah.
But it was degraded enough where it's kind of like, I bet U-Haul paid for that, but I don't know U-Haul paid for it. If it was shiny, I would be like, U-Haul paid for that. And so the entire drive up looking through the town, all I'm thinking is that a paid placement or not?
So you're thinking about U-Haul and not about the story.
I totally was.
They're in your
totally
brain.
For me. Yeah. Well, and it's because I want to protect myself from the subliminal, and therefore...
You just reinforced
and now
everybody, and everyone that hasn't seen the movie, all they know is there's a U-Haul ad maybe in it.
It's possible that any attention is good attention, so they'll take it.
Yeah, that's possible.
Who knows?
So, but do you all, when you recognize these placements, do you go, does it have a negative effect on the product when you see like a Coke can in a television show?
Well, I get the satisfaction of being a wise consumer, like, I'm on to you. But does it make me feel fonder about the product?
Or think of
them less? It makes me think worse of the content itself. Although Stephen Colbert's been playing with that quite a bit. You know, he does all those like super obvious product placement things where it's kind of like exaggerated enjoyment of the product. Particularly in the Colbert Show. I don't know about so much about his late night show.
Yeah, same.
But he's doing that there too. But we love him so much, so he kind of carries it. But in a way, it's a little more honest because in the 50s, it was like a brought to you by tobacco. You know,
well, that was more honest.
Texaco Theater.
I mean, that was at least very clearly honest that we're being presented by these companies.
Yeah.
More than that, they were using their own reputation on the show for advertising something, but at least you knew something about the person telling you about this.
Yeah.
And people have been wise to, ooh, the advertisers are trying to make us like their product. I mean, there was a sort of an anti don't believe the sensory experience type. Tome written in the 50s, you know. But this fellow, Charles Spence, says, no, I want people to actually just have a better experience with their product. So if you've done all your branding and said, here's this big expensive thing, and then you send it in bubble wrap versus, you know, sort of beautiful, crinkly tissue paper, which one of those experiences is going to be consistent with the brand that you've already set up?
It's interesting. It seems like it still feels to me like the huge move, the meta move, is towards novelty. So like first there was direct advertisement, buy this coffee. Then there was indirect coffee, or sorry, indirect,
indirect whatever. The coffee spritz,
right? Oh, yeah. Just like that. There's indirect coffee. Oh, excuse me. That was subliminal, right? Then we moved towards subliminal. Then now we're moving more towards super obvious. We're moving also towards native advertisement where it feels like it's the content itself, like the movie, or like, you know, what Facebook does with a newsfeed. And then we also have the kind of more sensory, which almost feels like a step beyond the indirect that we had before.
It's another play at enhanced authenticity. You know, like when Trader Joe's back in the early days, their advertisements looked like they were just written by the neighborhood guy who was really hoping you'd come into the store, or the Snapple lady, right? It's a totally different way of presenting the product when it just seemed like some schlub.
Yeah,
I think the reason it works though is because other people don't do it.
Because word of mouth is more powerful than you know, other forms of advertising.
But when you're talking about modifying the sound of the product to better to suit your qualities, mm-hmm. to suit what you want, you can think of that as kind of social engineering people, but you can also think of it as giving them what they want, right? If you make food that tastes horrible, not people are going to eat it. If it looks good and tastes good and sounds good, of course the human experience is going to be improved. So there's nothing necessarily bad about that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like Cooks Illustrated spends a lot of time researching how to make a recipe that's just so that the crust is crispy like mm-hmm. you want it to be, that it has tooth like you want it to have. So how is it any different? And I don't know. But it's something to pay. I'm watching it now. I've got my eye on those mm-hmm. advertisements.
When I eat a quiche, I definitely care about
egg water.
What the I don't like egg water. I definitely care about what the crust is like.
Right.
But I don't really give much thought to the sound of the quiche as I eat it. Mm-hmm. Same with potato chips. It's part of the experience, yes, but that's not part of what I look for in a potato chip. So
Martha Stewart might encourage people to waste their time on that aspect also.
I just feel like if you're manipulating things that the user is not looking for or seeking out, that to me feels like, it's not overtly positive manipulation.
I don't have a lot of faith that people know what they want necessarily. I mean, if I knew what I wanted, I wouldn't have to buy art. I could just create it because I have the skills to create art. But when I see something that's beautiful to me, it's not because I knew I was looking for that specific thing. It's because that
And you may not be able to break down all the reasons that add up to beautiful.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah. I take back what I said. Everything is so fuzzy. There's no black and white.
Do you want to make a good point with us? Please feel free to contact us online. We're on Twitter and Facebook and also Google+ and all those things. And you can find us by just looking for KOSP Geeks. That's our name online. This is Geek Speak, and we're about to talk about Brian's next endeavor. Last week, we heard all about Brian's phone adventures on how to get the right phone service, which he finally succeeded on. And this week, we're going to talk about payments. So stick with us, and we'll get to that in just a second. We'll be right back. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KOSP and KOSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, and I'm speaking with Brian Young, Ben Jaffe, and Bonnie Primsch.
Did you forget our names for a second there?
Yeah, he did.
I looked down and the script has other names, including my own. I'm not Bonnie and I'm not speaking with Lyle. Okay, in any case, Brian, last week you talked about your phones. This week we're going to talk about something else, technical, a story of yours. What have you been investigating lately?
Okay, once again, this kind of starts with a story from a long time ago. This was back in, 2009, I had my iPhone 3... G. Did I get that right? Not GS. Okay, so, and it's Christmas Eve. I'm running down to the store. I go to get that gift, the last gift that we need to get for Christmas morning.
Sure.
And the next morning, we're actually going to head off down to the grandparents' house before stores would
potentially open if they didn't open on that day.
Yeah, if they just happen to be open. So I go down there. I get in the store. It's a Borders Books. I go up to pay, and I realize I don't have my wallet. I have the gift, it's in my hand, and I can't pay for it. And the store is closing in about 20 minutes, which I live 40 minutes away from the store. It wasn't going to happen any other way. So I sit there and try to plead with them. I have a PayPal account. I have my credit card information locked in 1Password. I have all of these ways to pay.
You have the data.
I have the data. I have the numbers. They could punch it. I know they can punch it into the machine. But of course, that's against the rules. But
because they have to have that piece of plastic.
They have to have that piece of plastic. And they can take my money. They want to take my money. I want them to take my money. But
what's the problem?
They can't do it.
Couldn't they do it over the phone? Couldn't they have called your wife and your wife read out the numbers to them? I mean, I have done that in the past, but I guess it's a different type of purchase.
Yeah, you know, that specific one didn't come to mind, but they wouldn't have any of it.
See, if you go to the bookshop Santa Cruz, they would have helped you out.
So a nice local independent bookstore.
Yes, it is.
What kind of advertisement is that?
Oh, that was embedded, yeah.
That was embedded.
Sounded natural, didn't it?
There it is.
Getting the cash from the bookstore.
I wonder if we're getting cash from the bookstore.
You know,
we just wasted all that.
Bookstore paying a radio program.
Well, first off, we're public radio, so we don't have commercials.
Second of all, we're volunteer.
That's nor true. Do bookstore.
We actually lose money every week on the show.
And bookshops sadly don't have very much money either.
No.
So for all these years, I've been trying to...
Wait, what happened? Did you get the gift or not? Did you steal it?
I didn't get the gift.
Oh, no.
I can't remember how we solved the problem. I called my wife. I was sad. And we worked something out. But it wasn't the gift we were trying to get.
I think I'll finish the story. And then we went by Lyle's house, and he had a present for my son. So everything was fine.
Yeah, all gift wrapped and everything.
Going. So you wanted to be able to do this. And it seemed like all you need, you had the data. All you need is the system to do this.
Yeah. So finally, now we're getting to the point where we have payment systems that you could actually do that potentially with. If the clerk has the device that can accept NFC from your phone, from your iPhone or your Android.
Or QR codes if you have Bitcoin, which nobody still supports. No. Except for sushi restaurants, for some reason.
Yeah, of course.
I don't know why.
Fresh fish, gotta be fresh.
In fact, there's all kinds of systems coming out right now that are going to allow you to pay in different ways, and I wanted to cover some of them. But
assuming the retail updates their stuff, right? Because they don't necessarily have to get the newest stuff from Google or from Apple to get the new
payment systems. Quite put out. I went to a restaurant recently that was recently dealing with the chip, right?
Yeah.
Oh, the credit chip cards were going to get the chip, and they're like, well, we have to use this new machine, it's a stupid chip, so for now you have to do this workaround nonsense to get our tips right, and blah.
It
was very unexcited.
Every single time I swipe my card and then they say, oh, you need to use the chip. And then I put the thing in and it takes three times as long as it should.
So,
and I don't know what benefit I'm getting.
And they're not secure.
Not getting any benefit?
I thought the whole point was for it to be more secure.
Oh, we didn't cover the story, I don't think. But that little tiny chip sensor, you can put a sticker overlay on top of it to hack into it and just have the card be told that everything's good and give the data back out. So
essentially, one part of the chip holds the numbers.
Right.
And the other part of the chip is the logic that has the pin in it and will say, yes, that is the right pin.
The secure part, not secure.
Well, those two parts don't talk to each other. So if you overlay the right thing on there that's just going to always answer, yes, this is the right pin.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Then it'll just let you read the number off of it. So it's really...
That's over.
Yeah. Which I heard for 10 years when Europe was so far ahead of us on this that it really wasn't that much better security. Mm-hmm. All it is that since it doesn't have a magnetic strip, it isn't quite as easy to get a device that can read the number off of it.
In fact, that you can't read the pin out of it, but you can ask the card. But in any case, magnetic strip.
Yeah. So we have had magnetic strip readers for eons now to use credit cards. So what better way to solve the payment problem, what more universal way to be able to pay than having some card that just has a magnetic strip on it? But to increase the convenience, to increase the security, how about being able to program that magnetic strip on demand when you want to pay?
Okay.
What? Oh, like a fresh password or something?
Are you talking about the thing that you've been holding in your hand and gesticulating with for the last 5 minutes?
This is that thing called coin that was available from long ago.
So 2 years ago, my imagination got really, really captured by this. It was a Kickstarter. And it threatened to be one of the many Kickstarters that never actually comes to reality. But I waited. And I paid my money first, but I waited and I waited, and they kept sending updates, and it kept sounding like maybe this thing wouldn't happen. But I finally received mine. And
Ben, can you describe the Internet of thing you're holding right now?
This looks this just looks like a credit card, but it doesn't have numbers on it. It's got this little circle. When I push on it, it seems to be a button. It's got an e-ink screen, which doesn't look like a screen except that it changes when I push the button. And on the back, it has a strip, which looks like a magnetic strip. But I suspect it's actually not a normal traditional.
Let's talk about the screen on that for a second.
Script.
E-ink is the same thing that
the Kindle has.
Mm-hmm. The reflective Kindle, uh-huh. Not the power.
It's just a very, very small one. It's about the size of probably two of my thumbnails.
And what happens when you push that button?
Oh, it changes.
From
it changes
Visa to
something else. It looks like it just changes cards.
Okay.
That's kind of crazy.
Is that the thing that holds more than one card's worth of goo?
Yeah. So
goo.
All right, Brian, what's going on in that little thing? And it's called The Coin. It was a Kickstarter program. You finally got one.
And
have
also
you used it yet?
It's important to mention, so we don't sound too much like an ad, there are several of these companies that do something pretty much the same, right, as this.
Have you seen other devices like this? I have not seen one that works off the magnetic strip.
I don't know if they're shipping, but I know that there are many companies that are trying to do this.
So, yeah, all the credit card companies themselves are working on prototypes of this nature. No one has it shipped. This is the first one I've seen, and
this
I think
is crazy.
It's the first one shipped.
So what it doesn't have on there, it doesn't have that chip that you hate so much. So
it's just got the stripe.
But what's up with that magnetic strip, then?
Well, what's up with that strip is... It is. How would you describe this, Lyle? When you run the strip through the machine, it's doing a magnetic pulse.
Yeah. So let's talk about how it normally works. On a credit card you hold in your pocket, that magnetic strip on the back is just like an old analog tape. Ben, do you know what an analog tape is?
Yes, I know what it
is. Cassette tape.
Stop making jokes about my age. I'm almost 30.
Does that mean you could rewind it with your pencil?
You could rewind it with your pencil. So what's going on there is as a piece of magnetic strip, which actually basically is rust on a plastic medium, is moved over a magnet, you can change its magnetic permanency. And you can write ones and zeros, basically, on it.
Oh, it's like the little teeny tiny magnetic filings move.
Move, yeah. Oh. And so what you end up with is a pattern on that on the magnetic strip, very much like a barcode, but magnetic instead of visual. And so you can pass this thing into a reader or a writer, and you can put stuff on it, you can take stuff off. And the information that's actually on the magnetic strip is your address, your name, and your credit card number, and the expiration date. That's what's normally on there. And you can, it's the same thing as on your driver's license in California. So normally that's one thing, and it's always one thing until you get it reprogrammed. And you never get them reprogrammed. You throw them away and you get a new one from the company. This one, though, is not a magnetic strip on there. It just looks like one. And what's really happening on this one is there's a coil that induces a fluctuation just like reading that that stripy bit. But instead it kind of does it all the way across. So when this card detects that it's in a reader, which is a high magnetic read head, it starts to pulse like it was being read.
And then the thing is like, oh, you're Brian Young's card with this number.
That's
blah,
right.
Blah, blah.
I think it's
and
really easy to think about it like audio because really that's what everybody knows magnetic tape from.
And right. I bet if you took that card and you stuck it in a magnetic reader and moved it about an eighth of an inch, it would still work. Because I think the movement would trigger it and it would fire off its pattern. And the pattern isn't actually across the entire thing. The entire thing changes its inductance.
So does that mean you can still swipe it through a reader like a regular credit card?
Yeah, the reader thinks it's being swiped.
Exactly. In fact, you can even put ATM cards on here and put it in an ATM machine, which I have not been able to test yet. I have been, it's really bad to be testing payment systems because you know what? I've been spending a lot more money.
How many times has this worked? How many times has it failed?
So it started off really good. It started off at about, I don't know, 4 out of 5 times it was working. And then as I've worked on it for, almost 2 weeks now, I think I'm probably about 50-50.
Oh, so it's deteriorating or
something? No, it's not deteriorating. I'm just running into more and more cases in which you can't use it.
So not like you have a good use case and you try it and it fails, but more like, oh, actually, I can't use this.
Other different
I can't
situation?
Use this here because of this reason or that reason.
Well, I've been really trying to figure that out.
Technical rules or social rules? I mean, are they going, no, there's no numbers on this, so we don't accept this? Or
So the company gives you lots of different tips on what to do.
to make people take it?
In fact, you know how when you look at a regular credit card, especially an old regular credit card, it was really well branded on whether it was a Visa, MasterCard, and certainly American Express still is very well branded.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So when
that's
you
like
give
a
it,
blank, that your coin thing well, there looks like a non-card.
Yeah. To some merchant systems, that's actually needed. They need to press the right button on which system you're going to be using before you run the card. So I didn't know that, and I've only recently learned that.
So do you tell them then when you give it to them?
They recommend that you hand the card over and say, this is a Visa.
Okay.
And what I was surprised about, and this is really a mark of living in the Silicon Valley area, what I was really surprised about is I've handed this to probably 20 different merchants, and about a third of them go, oh yeah, these things are really cool. It wasn't the reaction of, hey, what are you trying to do here?
Right, they'd heard about it.
They'd seen it. These things are definitely getting around.
Fun fact, did you know that the first 4 digits of the credit card of a Visa, MasterCard, American Express, whatever American Express has 4, but those first 4 are actually denoting what type of card they are. You can see what the card type is.
Yeah, they're always the same for every Visa.
So you don't really need to know the type if you know the number. Of course, this thing doesn't have the number. You can't even read the number off of it.
Well, it does have 4 of the numbers.
Is that the first 4 or the last 4?
I believe that's the last 4.
It'd be the last 4.
Last
so you can't tell
those are the identifying numbers.
Mm-hmm. Additionally, a credit card number pattern has to match a certain algorithm. That's how you know it's a valid number, not necessarily that it can actually be charged against. So not all 4 sets of 4 numbers are valid on Visa.
So there are tips on getting a better success rate, but even the company that makes these says that you can't use it everywhere. There are certain systems that apparently it can't work on. In fact, the app on my phone, it, part of its purpose is to tell you which merchants you can use your card at. So
is,
we have
it,
not,
is this because the magnetic strip reader just works differently physically and it can't actually detect that magnet strip? Or is there other things going on? This, do you know?
Yeah, nobody that I've been able to talk to has been able to tell me.
Okay. How about Stripe, that payment system that people seem to use all the time, that little white square that you can sign, like when you're a mom-and-pop shop and you're reading them. Does it work on those?
I haven't been able. Well, actually, yes. Yes, it does. I have used it on, not Stripe. What's the other one?
Square?
Square, yes. Mm-hmm. I've used it on a Square system, which their terminals looked a little bit more robust than the simple little thing that pops into the phone. Mm-hmm. But certainly, it did work on those systems.
I think
actually
the white thing on this phone is also Square. I don't know what Stripe is. I think I was making that up. Sorry.
So well, what's funny is this device.
This, thing?
Yeah. This device actually comes with one of those little square thing that plugs in your phone.
Why?
That's how you get your card information from the actual physical credit card into your phone, and then the phone, using Bluetooth, is able to sync that over. Yeah.
Wait, why do they call it coin? It's not even round.
Bluetooth?
Low energy.
This thing has Bluetooth low energy.
This thing, okay, everybody, this card is a credit card. There's no extra thickness. It's just a credit card. It has a screen on it. It has Bluetooth in it. It has a button. And it's got a magnetic strip that changes its data. That's amazing. Even if it doesn't work everywhere.
And it hasn't been through the wash yet.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's not a good thing. How pricey was this project? Like, was this one of those, like, $200 Kickstarters?
And no, they asked for $50 for it.
Well, that's not bad.
It wasn't too bad. But, I mean, if it lives up to its promise.
$100,
it'd work all the time.
So the idea is eventually when this works all the time, you can just have this, whatever it is, whatever company you go with, you can have that in your wallet, and that's it, and not carry anything. And that's the appeal to me.
It's a race.
What?
It's a race. It's a race between a technology like this and how ubiquitous NFC readers and paying with your phone or your watch becomes.
Yeah, because I would love to get rid of the 5 credit cards and 4 ATM cards and, you know, blah, 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 blah that I have.
Yeah. And NFC specifically is like Apple Pay is NFC and also Google Pay. Is it called Google Wallet? Yeah. So I have a Google Wallet credit card because I moved away from Android, so I can't use Google.
What?
Yeah. It's actually an ATM card. I'll show it to you. So anyway, you can put money on your account on Google Wallet. And they can send you a free credit card, which is a MasterCard, but it's actually an ATM card.
Oh yeah, there it is.
Isn't that neat? Yeah.
So could I borrow that and see if I can get that onto my phone?
So he's gonna take my money from my and you can buy gifts directly from me for your children.
When coin doesn't work everywhere and you've got this thing.
Yeah, so how good is that one card to rule them all when it doesn't rule everything?
Right.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, it's not living up to the promise yet. And I'm not sure they ever will get there.
I just did a simple Google search. I did coin Kickstarter, and then one of the things I could choose from was coin Kickstarter fail.
Oh,
this is kind of sad.
Google completion.
Yeah.
Tells you everything you need to know.
It's a little embarrassing.
Would you recommend it?
No, I wouldn't recommend it yet. I'm still trying to get used to this thing, but it does have some really nice features to it that are security-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about how the chip that is now being required more and more does not truly have that great security. The way this thing works is you press the button on it, and it wakes up the e-ink display, and it shows me which card it's going to use. Well, that process, there's two things that can actually go on. One, when I did that right now, it talked to my phone, and my phone said, yep, I know that card. I'm paired with it. You can turn on.
Oh, so and you have to have the phone with the card.
Well, not have to. At this point, you can use it. Before that moment, before my phone acknowledged it, you can't actually use it. So that's a nice security feature. When you walk away after 7 minutes, this will turn itself off and it can't be used.
So I can't run away with that and go to the gas station and fill up.
Within
Unless
7 minutes.
Fast.
If I'm fast.
Unless you take his phone too.
Okay.
Yes. Or if it doesn't have a phone, you can actually do a little Morse code tap on the button. And I set up my code. And
What's
I did,
your code?
I didn't put it in one password. I don't know.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Well, so also, could you eventually set up, I mean, the software could update on the phone such that you had to unlock your phone with your thumb scanner to get that to work as well. Mm-hmm. So there's potential for improvement as well and more security.
And there's also a third thing, which I'd like to bring up, which is I can't take a picture of the table here and, you know, print a 3D key with your home keys and, you know, steal your credit card number and buy things online. I mean, the idea that you can take a picture and if someone's credit card happens to be in full view there, you can buy things with it. That's a huge security issue, right? And I can't do that with this.
Yeah. You also cannot get the security code off of the back of this if you're paying over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to still have other ways to get to your credit card information in that case too. No, I wouldn't recommend this yet, but so this the promise of this is exciting because of the whole wallet problem. Now, if only I can get cash to fold up smaller and smaller, maybe there would be some hope for that light pocket.
That's always the problem.
We have been talking about the Kickstarter project called Coin, which is a credit card which stores credit card numbers on it and theoretically replaces your credit cards, but he's saying not so much. A quick, short story to finish off the show.
Me?
You know what? Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So this is just something I was thinking about in terms of updating Internet of Things devices. This is something I didn't really cover in my story, but I was thinking one easy way to know if you need to update Chrome, which auto updates, is the little hamburger icon in the upper right-hand corner, the three lines.
Yeah.
If it's black, that means you're up to date. If it's green, it means you're actually one version behind. And if you reboot Chrome, it'll update. If it's orange, like it is with mine right now, it means you've left Chrome open for a really long time and you should close it.
And you should restart Chrome?
Yeah, just close it and reopen it and you've got the latest version.
And I would assume you actually need to quit it and reopen it, not just close the tab.
Yeah. You have to quit it.
So I learned two things just now. One is that that little icon changes colors, which
it does.
I was not aware of. And two, that it's called a hamburger icon. That is adorable.
Well, yours is black, so you're safe.
Mine's green. It looks like a hamburger. That's why.
Yeah. Delicious.
And on a phone, they call it hamburger in the basement because they put all the other features in the basement where you can't find them.
Under the hamburger dropdown.
Hey, if you'd like to join the conversation, please feel free to do so anytime you'd like up at geekspeak.org. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geekspeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you'd like it. Just let them know the geek said hi. This is Independent Public Radio, 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. To find out more about any episode of Geekspeak, including this one, just go to geekspeak.org. We have a whole bunch of notes about what we've done today and what we talked about. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxa with Ben Jaffe, Bonnie Jean Primsch, and Brian Young. Hey, geeks, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for letting us be here again.
Thanks to our intern Chandler and our Canadian correspondent Greg Merkley, and thank you for being here for the November 7th, 2015 episode of Geekspeak. We'll see you next week.